You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a recent survey shows that almost half of U.S. workers say they've cried on the job. A psychologist joins us for a look at crying at work, why we do it, and how people react to it. First, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on a big case from Wisconsin this morning. That's Gill versus Whitford, a case challenging the state's Republican-drawn legislative maps. The court unanimously kind of kicked the case down the road to a lower court, punting on the question of how much is too much partisan gerrymandering. It means the state's districts will remain unchanged before this year's midterm election. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief. He was at the Supreme Court in October for oral arguments in the case. He's with us now to talk about the decision. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Well, we touched base on Friday. We're all waking up every Monday wondering if this is the week it's going to drop. It finally dropped.
Here it is.
It's a little anticlimactic.
A little bit, because it's still going. It's still out there. This case that went before the Supreme Court on October 3rd of last year, they've had all this time to decide on it, and they didn't just reject the case completely. They didn't dismiss it completely. They remanded it to the federal court that issued the initial decision on it. So the case is still alive. But in terms of the 2018 election, it changes absolutely nothing. These legislative maps that were drawn in 2011 will remain as they were drawn, you know, 7 years ago.
All right. Let's stay with that point for a bit before we dig further in this decision. There was an outside chance if they'd ruled for the plaintiffs, they said, yeah, this redistricting, it went too far. There was an outside chance late in the game that they might have said, hey, redraw these lines in time for August primaries. That, I guess, that probably wasn't going
to
happen.
The closer it gets to an election, the more of a long shot that would have been. Of course, when they filed this case a couple of years ago, maybe it didn't seem like a long shot, but the justice system moved slowly on this one. The court system, the Supreme Court, has never said that a redistricting plan can be too partisan to the point that it's a partisan gerrymander. So I guess you expect some slow movement on an issue like this, given that they've never taken that leap, but it went especially slow.
And I imagine the people in charge of elections here in the state, whatever they thought about the merits of the case, are breathing a sigh of relief that, in fact, they're not having to scramble to, figure out what the maps are going to be and then how to prepare for those.
Yeah, they know what they're going to be dealing with this year, whereas if the court had said, you know, this is an if because they didn't say this, but if they had said these are unconstitutional, there would have been challenges and counter challenges over what to do in 2018. But again, that's not happening.
All right, let's look at the reasoning in the case, because people were watching this case and thinking this could be the case that decides if partisan redistricting can hit a threshold that makes it unconstitutional, not on racial grounds, which has happened before,
right,
but by how people divvy up voters from each party.
Yeah, people thought that it would either be the case that says you can do that or you can't. And the court said neither, went right down between those two options and did not decide on the merits of the case one way or the other. They sent it back to the district court based on standing in the case. The court said that, and this was Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote that he made it very clear that they weren't addressing the merits of the case. They were just addressing the standing, and essentially the court said that the plaintiffs who brought this case, the specific plaintiffs who brought Wisconsin case, could not show statewide standing, and they couldn't show that they were personally injured in a redistricting case. And so they're not the ones to bring this case, at least not in this format, as a 14th Amendment claim.
Yeah. So if I understand this right, they said, okay, you might be able to prove that in the district that you got drawn into, you might be able to prove harm to you somehow. So why are you telling us about the whole state? Because you don't live in every district in the state.
Yeah. And just the lead plaintiff in the case is William Whitford, who lives in Madison. And he is always going to have a Democratic assembly district. Whether or not the court redrew it under a kind of a, quote, model plan that was more competitive, William Whitford's district was always going to be Democratic. And so that, to the Supreme Court, was a trouble area. And they all said, you know, we don't think you have standing. Even though some justices had different ideas of what the court could do next, they all agreed that the standing issue was not satisfied here.
9-0.
It's a little tricky, okay?
But all nine agreed
on
the standing thing.
All nine agreed on the thing that we don't have standing. Yes,
right.
There's some disagreement as you split off from there, but all of them, all nine agreed that they don't have standing, and you need that.
talking to Sean Johnson about this morning's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on a challenge to Wisconsin's redistricting law. So where the disagreement starts to come in, Sean, is what happens next? They didn't say no standing, get out of here, we're done with this.
They did not. They said Chief Justice John Roberts sent it back to the district court. And so plaintiffs now have the opportunity to look at what the Supreme Court said was missing in this case and correct it, you know, change their case, basically, and run it back up to the Supreme Court again. And so at least, you know, one election law expert that I talked to said he thinks that the court will absolutely hear this case again, that Wisconsin's case is not done. It'll go back to the Supreme Court.
Now, this standing issue, and this came up through lower courts, lower federal courts. Did they say, hey, we're not so sure about this standing thing?
This is one of the only things that Justice Anthony Kennedy talked about at oral arguments, if I remember right, is definitely something that Wisconsin's Department of Justice argued during arguments on this on October 3rd of last year, that you got to satisfy that standing, that it is a technicality, okay, that the court really didn't get into this underlying and thorny idea of how partisan is too partisan when it comes to our democracy and the drawing of maps. But they definitely addressed the standing issue in arguments, and this is something that obviously the justices ultimately had a problem with at the end of the day.
Now, there was some disagreement, as I understand it. A couple of the justices said, okay, yes, 9-0 standing. A couple of them thought, and we should be done now.
Yeah, that was Justices Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch. Thomas had a very brief concurrence who said, you know, we agree with all that stuff about no standing, but normally when a case doesn't have standing, we dismiss it. You know, essentially we kill it. And here what the court did is they remanded it. So the case is still alive.
And Justice Kagan wrote her own separate thing about this. Where was she going with that?
Yeah, so she was emphatic in saying she agreed with Justice Roberts that this case does not have standing. So mechanically, they're all on the same page on that one. But Justice Kagan said, you know, she made a point of saying that gerrymandering is a pretty serious problem for democracy. And she also talked about, you know, if they bring this case back up, how might you structure it so it's a little different? You know, you could go district by district and find voter after voter in these districts who has seen their votes, you know, cracked or packed are the terms that get thrown around in redistricting, you know, cracked meaning like if you take Democratic voters and break them up among a variety of districts so that they never quite break that 50% threshold in any of them, packed so that they're all in one district and they don't get to affect others. Essentially, what she's saying is find voters spread throughout the state who can show that personal injury in each of these districts to the point that it becomes a statewide claim. She also raised the prospect of bringing this as a First Amendment claim instead of more of a 14th Amendment claim. Without going into that too much, she quotes pretty heavily from Justice Anthony Kennedy on why you might want to do that.
Justice, from a previous ruling.
Yeah, Kennedy wrote the decision in 2004. That is really the reason we're talking about any of this right now. He left the door open to a partisan gerrymandering claim of some kind back in 2004. And so everybody was doing this case was made for Anthony Kennedy. Essentially, he did not write in any of these decisions, by the way.
So what's now for plaintiffs? They've been rejected in the sense that they didn't get the ruling they wanted. The door's still open. What are they saying they're going to do now?
They're saying that we got to decide what we're going to do next, which is understood hours after the decision is released. But one option for them is to go district by district and get 20 to 30 plaintiffs in districts throughout Wisconsin who can say, look, this map made it impossible for me to exercise my voice in assembly district blank. You know, you get enough of them, you get critical mass. And whether or not it's a quote statewide claim, if you have to redraw 20 or 30 districts, you got to redraw the whole map practically. So that's one option they could do. They could also follow the template that Kagan's thrown out there as a free speech or a freedom of association type of a lawsuit. Bring it that way. But it's going to go back to court. And that district court that ruled Wisconsin's map unconstitutional a couple years ago now, probably going to get a chance to revisit it again.
What are we hearing from the state now and from Republicans who drew these maps?
I mean, they're happy. Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel called it a victory for the rule of law. praised the Department of Justice lawyers who handled this case, but it was a very brief statement. You know, it would be an odd place for them to do a victory lap because this is going to end up back in court in some way or another. And so, you know, we'll see what form that takes. But I think every indication here from the court, from plaintiffs, from election law experts is that this thing is still alive, that the court's decision today didn't really decide anything.
Took a long time to get here. These are maps that were drawn in 2011. This whole process could take us, I don't know, to 2021 when we're drawing new maps anyway.
So, yeah, here's the timing issue that becomes really important over the next couple of years, and the reason that the court kind of has to decide it this next go around one way or the other. You know, either has to say you can become too partisan in this process or not, or they just have to say, you know, like, we haven't found that metric. Whoever wins the 2020 elections on these maps is going to draw the next maps, you know, for the next decade. So there's a census in 2020. That means in 2021, the new, you know, redistricting plan will be drawn that is in place for the next decade. So if there's a gerrymandered map, you know, then that's going to affect who gets to win that election and draw the next map.
So the Supreme Court didn't deal on this. They didn't do, was it Maryland with a Democratic drawn map? States really don't have guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court, briefly.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really brief decision in the Maryland case, but a similar outcome. You had basically a redistricting case that was brought against a single congressional district there, different grounds, drawn by a different party, same outcome. The court has not weighed in on this issue.
Sean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief with us to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Wisconsin's redistricting case, where the court found that the Democratic challengers of the state's maps did not have standing to bring the case, sending it back to a lower court. First, have you ever cried at work? Maybe you have an overbearing boss, a combative coworker, or a workload that's through the roof. If so, you definitely have company. According to a recent study by the staffing firm AccountTemps, 45% of American workers say they have cried on the job. About the same percentage of bosses say that's okay as long as you don't do it all the time. About a third of workers say crying at work is never okay because people will think you're weak or immature. So to cry or not to cry on the job, and how should bosses and coworkers react? Stacy Nye is a clinical professor and director of the psychology clinic at UW-Milwaukee. Stacy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, no problem.
Well, this survey of workplaces finds roughly 45% of people, it looks like, say, yeah, I've cried at work at some point. Does that surprise you? It's kind of a lot of people.
No, that doesn't surprise me too much. I think that work can be a stressful place, and it's not unusual for someone to maybe tear up a little bit or feel overwhelmed or frustrated about something that they might cry.
Is there a stigma that attaches to crying at work?
Unfortunately, yes. I think it's viewed as unprofessional amongst most workplaces. Certainly male-dominated workplaces, it's seen as unprofessional, but not just male-dominated, female too.
And speaking of gender, are women more likely to cry at work than men, or is it accepted more for men or women to cry at work?
Well, women are more likely to cry in general, first of all, so it makes sense that they would be more likely to cry at work. And I think it probably depends on the workplace, how it is received. So as I said, in male-dominated workplaces, it's probably frowned upon. Possibly in more female-dominated workplaces, it would be more accepted, but still only on a limited basis. If you're someone who's crying regularly at work, that's seen as unprofessional. In general,
let's pull the camera back from crying in particular and talk about expressing emotion at the workplace. Is it seen as more acceptable to express anger at the workplace, maybe because anger is an emotion associated more with men?
Well, I think you're probably right about that. So I think, but I think it would also depend on how you express your anger. So if you're saying, you know, I'm angry that you did that, Rob, because I wasn't prepared for that, versus, hey, Rob, you know, and getting all yelling in your face and swearing, that's never seen as an okay thing to do, although I know that happens.
So for the person, to the extent we have control over whether we cry in the workplace, are we going to feel better or worse afterward?
So it depends on, again, where you are and who you're with. So if you cry at work and you're with people that are accepting, then you might feel better afterwards. If you cry at work and you're with people who are not accepting and might shame you, then you're going to feel worse. So it's mostly recommended that if you feel like you might cry, to take a breath, calm down, and maybe excuse yourself and go to your office and close the door, or go to a bathroom, someplace private where you can cry a little bit. Most people say when they've cried at work, they feel worse.
Worse after.
Yeah.
So why would that be? Just because maybe they've done it in front of people and feel judged because of that?
Yes, yes. Absolutely. They feel judged. They feel like it's unprofessional. And they feel like they've lost control. So having control of your emotions is part of the picture here. And so if you have good control, then you maybe would be less likely to not only cry at work, but yell at someone at work versus... If you're someone who doesn't have control and you cry, then you not only feel frustrated and overwhelmed at the work situation, but then you feel disappointed in yourself that you've lost control.
Do you have any advice for someone who finds themselves in this position often? They feel like, hey, I'm more prone to cry than other people seem to be under similar conditions. Are there ways to rein it in, I guess, if they want to, or to hold it off, as you say, till they have that private moment?
I think practicing deep breathing and mindfulness might help. You can do that at your desk all the time, you know, and it's just a good thing to do if you have a stressful job. So, you know, taking some nice deep breaths, and it would be good to practice this ahead of time. If, you know, you can't just expect that if you feel like crying and you the first time ever you do deep breathing that it might help. But so practicing some deep breathing and some calming techniques might help someone in a situation like that.
Talking to Stacy Nye, clinical professor and director of the psychology clinic at UW-Milwaukee, about crying at work. Is there something to be said to someone in management, Stacy? If you're a manager and you say, hey, people seem to be crying in my workplace a lot or running off to cry off-site or something like that, maybe this isn't an individual problem. Maybe there's something we can do to make this a less stressful place.
Well, if someone could realize that all of their employees are crying at work, I would hope that they would take a moment to, you know, have a focus group maybe, or bring everyone together and say, hey, what's going on here that, you know, people seem to be really unhappy. I'm not sure that that happens very often, but I would like to think that that could happen.
I'm not sure how much research there is in this. This poll looked at some of the causes of crying. What are some of the common instances that might lead to this kind of negative emotion at work?
Well, people cry in general for various reasons, not just because they're sad. We cry when we're scared. Sometimes we cry when we're angry, overwhelmed or frustrated or feeling helpless. And I think those are pretty similar experiences at work. I think sadness probably wouldn't come up at work, you'd hope, but often feeling overwhelmed or feeling angry or, you know, feeling frustrated or helpless, dealing with someone else or a situation. So I think those would be the most common instances when people might cry at work. Certainly, if you have a death in the family and you cry, that might be not frowned upon as much, but again, in a very limited way. Most of the things that I read talked about getting your emotions in check, and crying is for your house or your car, not your office.
Now let's step into the shoes of a coworker. Somebody in the office or work site is crying for whatever reason. This is my off-site BFF. They're not a close friend. How can I give a person space? How can we not create that situation of judgment that's going to make things worse?
Well, I would say that if you see a coworker crying, that you might just say, do you need anything? Is there anything that I can do for you right now? And then just kind of take it from there. But you raise a good point. One of the problems with crying at work is people feel that they have to soothe someone who's crying. And so now, again, it becomes an environment that's not very professional, and you're taking care of everybody there. So So that can be awkward. It can create some awkward space for people. But certainly I wouldn't just ignore someone crying at work. I would just approach them and a couple words, anything I can do, and then give them space if they say no.
So according to this survey we started off with, this happens common enough that it seems like we should have, I don't know, kind of an etiquette in place. We should know how to deal with this. But it seems like we really don't, do we?
No, we really don't. And I think sometimes we don't know how to deal with it in our personal lives either. I think men are not trained to deal with people who cry, men or women. They have some evidence that testosterone levels lower when men see women cry or see anyone cry. So they feel kind of helpless in those situations and don't know how to react. And I think women feel really torn because women are socialized to relate to other women and other people and take care of them. But now you're in the workplace, and maybe that's not what's expected from you. So I think it's hard to know what to do in those situations.
As we wrap up, let's look at, again, the person who is crying. What do you say to someone who has had that emotional instance at work, cried, feels bad about it, maybe feels embarrassed about it? How do we bounce back there?
The person who's cried?
The person who's cried, yeah.
I would say that person should just move on with their work. I wouldn't apologize necessarily. I wouldn't draw a lot of attention to it. Business as usual. You know, just move on with your work and, you know, be as professional as you can. And I wouldn't draw a lot of attention to the fact that you cried at work.
We'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Stacy Nye is a clinical professor and director of the psychology clinic at UW-Milwaukee. We talked with her about a recent survey showing that nearly half of all workers cry on the job. Now, home prices, for the most part, are rebounding. 10 years after the start of the Great Recession, those prices have been on the move for a while now. Depending on where you live, you might have seen skyrocketing home housing costs in recent years. For example, according to the real estate website Zillow, the median home value in Wisconsin is nearly $177,000, and home values have increased more than 6% in the last year. That's expected to keep going up. For home buyers, the increase in prices can make navigating the market tricky, and then throw in some outside influences, things like tariffs and federal interest rate hikes. That can have an impact on mortgages and home prices. Situation may be similar for people renting, too. Andra Gent is an associate professor of real estate and urban land economics for the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Business. Andra, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, we hear about rising housing costs around the country. What are things looking like in Wisconsin now?
You know, Wisconsin's not an especially hard-hit part of the country. You know, so the background here is that, housing costs are up. Rents have been rising in real terms. This is especially true for the bottom half of the income distribution, where the share of what they're spending as a fraction of their household income on rent has been rising nationwide. Now, we don't have some of these super supply-constrained cities like the Los Angeles, the New York, the San Franciscos. We don't have the same level of supply constraints, but certainly that's not much consolation if you're looking to either rent or buy a home in Wisconsin because prices are still up. It's a little bit worse in Madison than in the rest of the state.
Yeah, when we say housing prices are up, are we saying they've gotten back to where they were before the Great Recession, or are they pacing past that now?
They're a little bit past that now, not by a ton, but they're definitely past that. It's certainly in nominal terms, about there in real terms. When I say real terms, I mean after we adjust for inflation overall. And now, again, Madison, house prices have been rising a little bit faster in Madison than in the rest of the state, about the same in Milwaukee as the rest of the state, not surprisingly, because, of course, Milwaukee is so much of our population, and then maybe a little bit less in some of what we call second-tier cities like the Green Bays and the Beloit and Janesville.
Are we seeing houses, home sales moving pretty quickly now?
I think overall, yes, that's broadly true. When something comes on the market, there's definitely not a ton of supply. I haven't looked in the exact numbers on how many months supply we have. Certainly in Madison, it's a very small number of months of supply, but I think we're below our long-term average in terms of months of supply is typically 6 months, and I think Madison, last I heard, was something like 2 months or 3 months. So things seem to be going off the market very quickly when they do come on.
Yeah, it seems like when we talk about housing costs, as you've been saying things here, the big question is, where are we talking about? There are these hot spots around the country, in Dane County in particular, in Wisconsin, but it really is local conditions, maybe more than national conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. There is no the housing market. There is no national housing market. There is... Each city has a housing market. There are some national factors. Now, obviously, interest rates are a big part of the story, but, you know, I think 25% maybe of the variation in home prices can be explained by national factors. So mostly it's state or even very local factors. So what's going on, even though house prices are sort of rising across Wisconsin, it's definitely much, much stronger in a place like Madison and Milwaukee than some of these rural areas where they're really barely recovered from the boom. And they may not, you know, certainly when you get outside of even, you know, smaller cities, you know, the migration away from rural areas is probably going to continue. It's hard to see those prices recovering too much.
And that sounds like a structural problem. Maybe if I'm living in a rural area, I want to move to a place to get a good job. Well, the places I want to move have very expensive houses. The place I'm leaving, if I'm trying to sell a house, I'm not going to get anywhere near that much for it.
Yeah, so that's a great point you raise. You know, a couple thoughts. One, you know, so this is something people notice about cities is there's a lot of poor people in cities, and that's somewhat, you know, Ed Glaser sometimes describes that as a symbol of the success of a city in that, you know, cities attract people because they have employment opportunities. And so the fact that there's many people who, you know, might not be able to afford the new housing prices, that's not necessarily a bad thing. The other thing I would point out is, in my view, I don't actually think that homeownership is a great way to build wealth. In my view, I don't see big advantages in terms of building wealth of being a homeowner relative to a renter. So I don't know that I'd be that worried about being a renter as opposed to a homeowner for that reason. There's certainly some consumption benefits of being a homeowner, but I'm not sure it's a great improvement over renting for your financial situation.
Talking to Andra again from UW-Madison School of Business about housing costs in Wisconsin and around the country. Andra, let's talk about those renters. Again, it seems like there are hot spots where rent seems to be going up pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think that, again, Dane County is particularly under pressure, and that's partly it does have these supply constraints because of the capital. Obviously, I'm very familiar with the Madison market. I'm a little bit less familiar with the Milwaukee market. But again, this is that part, the long-term trend, that is somewhat nationwide just because as people, you know, we had a widening of the income distribution, and everybody's sort of competing for the same land in a certain sense. And so there is a nationwide trend, as well as in Wisconsin, of a larger and larger fraction of income going towards rents, particularly for the bottom half of the income distribution.
I was seeing a national report from a group that deals with homelessness and housing issues saying that for people at a minimum wage in any state, basically, I think they said, nowhere in the country can you really afford to pay the rent on one minimum wage. Does that sound accurate?
I think that sounds about right. That's particularly when you take into account family size. You know, if you take into account having two kids with one minimum wage, I mean, it seems extremely difficult.
I want to talk about a couple big national factors that I've seen people talking about. One is the Federal Reserve. They're bumping up interest rates. We see these stories from time to time. It seems pretty abstract and distant. Is this something that eventually trickles down and affects people who are buying and selling homes or renting housing?
Yeah, so certainly rising long-term rates, mortgage rates as they go up, that makes a mortgage payment a larger fraction of people's income. That's certainly true. Now, that might also, you know, that feedback feeds back onto house prices, in the extent that if there's less people that can bid on a house because they can't qualify for the mortgage or they choose not to to take up that much of their income to buy a home, then house prices don't get bid up as much. So there's somewhat of a dampening effect from that end. But, yeah, certainly rising rates make it harder to buy a home because the mortgage payment is going to be higher.
And then tariffs have been in the news a lot lately. Some home builder groups are pointing toward tariffs on Canadian lumber, the stuff that a lot of houses are built out of, driving up costs significantly enough that it's adding to the price of a new house. Do you see that being a factor?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, also we have a very low unemployment rate here in Wisconsin. And that's good, right? We don't. Unemployment is creates a lot of problems. But it also means even before we had all this these problems with tariffs, labor was very, very scarce in the construction industry. And that's true nationwide, but maybe especially true in Wisconsin. And that does feed into another policy, the immigration policy. And, like it or not, we do get a decent amount of labor from our neighbors to the south, particularly in the construction industry. And so to the extent you don't have that labor coming in, that raises labor costs, which I think, not to say that tariffs aren't important and raw materials costs are not an important part of construction, but I think an even bigger part is the construction cost, the labor cost. And those have been up for a few years now, and there doesn't seem to be any signs of those damping. And then you throw in the fact that, yeah, raw materials, lumber prices, steel prices, those are all going up. None of it is suggesting that the cost of building a house from scratch is going down, at least in terms of the building cost.
We heard from Brandy on Facebook, who writes that housing costs make her want to stay put. She says her mortgage rate is much lower than what it is out there right now. And I thought I read somewhere, Andra, that Brandy's not alone. The average time people stay in a house, stick with that mortgage, has gone up a decent chunk in recent years. Is that right?
So that's probably because a lot of people got their mortgage rates when it was very low, right? So there's a couple things going on. So if you bought at the boom, you may not have had as much equity, right? So you need a few things to be able to refinance. You need a job. Typically, they want to see that you have stable income. And then you also need some equity in your home to refinance. So a lot of people just couldn't refinance if they had bought their home in 2006, 2007, up until the last couple of years, because they didn't have enough home equity. And then the other issue is there's not much incentive to refinance if your mortgage rate's sitting at 3.5%, why would you refinance into a higher rate?
Talking to Andra Gent right now about rising home prices and an expensive rental market in many communities anyway around the country. She is an associate professor of real estate and urban land economics for the UW-Madison School of Business. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you looking to buy or sell a house? What are you seeing as you go from house to house searching for a place to buy? Did you sell a house quickly? Are you renting? Is the rent, to paraphrase, too darn high for you in your community? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about home prices in Wisconsin, whether you buy or rent, and why in many communities anyway it feels so expensive. It seems like things are going up. Andra Gent is with us, associate professor of real estate and urban land economics for the UW-Madison School of Business. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know your story, the story in your community. Are you buying or selling? Have you done so recently? Are you looking at the market and saying, no thanks, gonna stay put? If you rent, is it easy to find something in your price range, or do you really have to stretch that budget to find a place to live where you want to live? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Jackie is with us in Monona. Jackie, hi. Jackie, are you there? We don't have Jackie. Maybe your phone's on. Oh, Jackie, are you there?
Yes, hi. Sorry, my phone was on hold.
Okay, go for it.
I was going to say my husband and I purchased a home several years ago in Monona, which is in Dane County, and we're looking to sell it. We're projected to make a large profit on our home. However, we are planning to purchase a home within the same community. So any profit that we've just made will essentially have lost because we are selling high and buying high.
Jackie, thanks for that call. Andra, that's a quandary for people within a hot housing market. Yeah, great, they make money, but if they want to stay there, they are not, they're in the same boat. They're paying a lot for it.
Yeah, so this is a great point, and it's one of the reasons some people don't really, there are economists who don't really think of housing wealth as wealth. And the reason is exactly as Jackie's saying, well, you know, I still have this, so you can think of yourself as sort of born short. If you have a liability that you have to buy housing every period, right? So you can either rent it every month, every month you could rent housing, or you can buy it and basically lock in your housing. But when you sell your house, unless you're downsizing a lot, or you're near the end of your life, or you're moving to a different community, well, then you got to buy housing somewhere else. And so in some sense, and if the price of your house goes up, if it went up because rents went up, so your future liability went up, you're not really in a better situation. So that's one reason, you know, we don't necessarily think of housing wealth as wealth the same way we do at other assets. So I'm sorry for Jackie. You know, on the other hand, look at the bright side. I think one of the reasons that you're seeing housing going up in Dane County is people want to move here. So that's sort of a sign that you're in a community that offers a lot of amenities that's attracting people nationwide and keeping a lot of the educated millennials that come to UW-Madison and stay. So that's the good news.
Jackie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Yeah, Andrew, I think a lot of people over the decades have thought of that house as a thing that's going to appreciate over time. It might fund their retirement. The equity might fund the kids' college career, whatever. Is that something that used to be more true than it is now, or was that never really true?
Yeah, I'm not sure that. You know, I think, again, I wouldn't have thought it. Now, it does give you something to borrow against. So the one nice thing about housing is it gives you collateral that lenders are willing to lend against, whereas lenders are generally a little bit more hesitant to lend against your future labor income, what we consider sort of unsecured income. And so for a collateral perspective, houses have always been valuable, but I don't think it's any more or less true in terms of whether housing is real wealth or not, because, again, anytime the price goes up, it's because your liability, your future stream of rents, has also gone up.
Thanks for that call, Jackie. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your housing story? Do you buy or rent? Why are you doing it that way? Are you looking to sell, looking to buy? What are you running into in the community you are looking to buy or rent in? 800-642-1234 is the number. We're talking to Andra Gent from the UW-Madison School of Business. Andra, I think a thing probably that keeps a lot of economists and people in your line of work up at night is, are we entering the conditions that led up to 2008 and the Great Recession? Do you have any compare and contrast thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Rob. Fantastic question. I don't think, you know, we may see some trend downward in prices as rates rise. You know, we're at a very... You know, we're at very full employment right now, and so that's consistent with, of course, the Fed raising rates to sort of make sure inflation doesn't get out of control. What I think that was a little bit different about, there's a few things that were a little different pre-2008. So first of all, the rent-to-price ratio got really out of whack, and what we're seeing now is rents are also rising, and so that's not as much of a concern. Now, of course, that's not good if you're a renter, but when we sort of think of asset price bubbles, often one of the hallmarks of an asset price bubble is seeing the income on the asset not keep pace with the price appreciation. And the way people were talking in 2004, 2005, and especially, you know, as late as 2006, people were saying, well, I'm buying in anticipation of the price appreciation. And that's when, as economists, you know, alarm bells go off, because if you're not seeing the income, well, then you're expecting somebody else to get, you know, do you see what I mean? It's a bit of a... It's only about the house price expectations at that point, as opposed to the real income. And so I don't think that's what's going on right now. The other thing, as you probably know, is if anything, lending conditions are still tighter than they were in 2002, 2004, even before we had this big relaxation in lending conditions in 2005, 2006, 2007. It's still fairly difficult, particularly for marginal home buyers, to qualify for a mortgage. Mortgage markets, the underwriting standards are much tighter. And so that's not going to be a factor. But I think the big thing is house price expectations are not nearly as out of whack as they were prior to the financial crisis.
I want to bring on another caller now. Sandy is with us in Wausau. Sandy, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just wanted to tell of an experience I had looking for housing in Wausau, Wisconsin, which I'm sure it's the same around the United States. Being low-income housing, there's like a hair of a difference of whether you make too much money or not enough. Even the low housing bracket of what you pay for housing is way too expensive for people in poverty to afford. Considering the cost of medical care, feeding your children, and housing, it's way too much, and there's way too much red tape in order to get a roof over your head. That has been my experience.
Sandy, thanks a lot for that call. Andra, we hear about Section 8 housing, various forms of government support for housing. Are there a lot of hoops to jump through, as Sandy is saying?
I don't work in that area specifically myself, but I certainly believe, Sandy, that's the experience. There are a number of programs, both federal and state level, to try to increase the supply of affordable housing. What Section 8 is one program. I mean, there's a number of community block development grants. A lot of it is really on developers to try to give developers the incentive to develop affordable units. And I think that's sort of the best way of doing it, is to try to give these developers the incentives. But, it's tough out there. And, as we talked earlier, the share of income going towards housing just keeps going up especially in the bottom half of the income distribution. And I don't have an easy answer for that, unfortunately. I wish there were, and it's not an easy policy answer either. There's not a simple suggestion as to whether, you build more affordable housing or whether you give direct. I mean, one alternative is rather than give affordable housing program incentives to developers, do you just give lower-income households vouchers to buy housing, or do you just directly support their income? That's another program that we might consider if we wanted to ease the burden on low-income households. But unfortunately, that's just sort of it's a big problem, and I don't have a solution.
Sandy, thanks for that call, and good luck. Briefly, as we wrap up, Andra, what is the next bit of information? What's the next clue you're watching for the future of housing?
I think the tariffs are really going to be a big part of the story. As you probably know, when any time you start these trade wars, the end is not in sight, right? So if we could just say it's going to be these two products, that's great. But, that this could have big macroeconomic ramifications, not just for the housing market, but for the overall U.S. economy. So I think that's something we want to keep an eye on.
Andra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Andra Gent is an associate professor of real estate and urban land economics for the UW-Madison School of Business. She was with us to talk about why buying or renting seems to be getting more expensive, especially in particular communities, and the factors that play into costs in the housing market. Again, whether you're buying or renting.